At the end of the day, he came to Bethlehem because he came to be with us, each one of us now here. And one way to beautifully symbolize that is by putting the plants of our land around the birth of Jesus, because he came to us.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. We are approaching yet another Advent season together, a season of making space to wait on God. Now, maybe you're really good at making that space. Maybe you're like a cat and you have no problem just flopping down where you are, maybe in front of a fireplace, stretching your legs, being quiet and letting Jesus take the wheel. Good for you. That's wonderful. Or maybe you are addicted, like the rest of us, to work, to control and productivity, to entertainment, perhaps even to podcasts. And Advent, getting quiet, feels like a struggle or a sacrifice. Or maybe you're moving house or changing jobs, or you're working three jobs because you have to. And as you tap into God's grace for this season, that interior grasp of his love is what slowing down is going to mean for you. Or finally, maybe waiting, being still, not being able to go anywhere or do anything much is not an option for you. It's just your life. Advent is just your life in this season, whether you ask for it or not. That's where our guest today found herself in a season of her life. And in that long, involuntary season of Advent, she found herself thinking and remembering her childhood in Provence, France. And this all slowly wove a contemplative fabric of wondering how God shows up for us in plants, in landscapes, and in different cultures. And so this Advent journey brought her to writing a little Advent book about nature, the seasons, and the tradition of enculturating manger scenes. How might the creche or nativity, and not only this time of year, help draw us to that place of fresh and radical encounter with God in place? Our guest today is Sylvie Van Hooser. Sylvie is a certified botanic artist, retired French teacher, and author of two books of nature sketches and meditations, The Art of Living in Advent, 28 Days of Joyful Waiting, which we'll talk about today, as well as The Art of Living in Season, a year of reflections for everyday saints. I recommend her Advent book as a devotional during this time of year, but you should at least check out the show notes to see some of her drawings. I'm looking forward to sharing our conversation today, and it'll include some French words. So here's a brief glossary. Creche, another word for manger scene. In the creche, you'll find santons, or little saints, clay figurines based on ordinary people. We will also talk about terroir, which means a people's land and all the life in it, essentially. And I will not ask you to excuse my French, not this time. Now, remind yourself where you've stored away your nativity set, because after this conversation, you might want to get it out. I hope that it helps you this year remember, receive, and share the gospel over the next few weeks. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. Sylvie, I just have to say, your book is so unique. I've never quite read anything like it in terms of an Advent devotional. It's in full color illustrations throughout the book. It's succinct. It's lovely. I felt like your book was sort of like taking a walk in the country. Have you always been someone who's interested in nature and nature drawing, or is that something that came up later in life?
I've always been interested in nature, definitely. Grew up close to the land with a deep love for an understanding for how connected we are to the land. Even though I was not a Christian, I felt there was something really deep there, and also how unique each area was. And my area was unique because of the land, because of the hills, because of the vegetation that grew there and that infiltrates not just the hills, but the kitchens and, you know, all of that. So that was always a big part of me.
Your book really touched me. I've never read a book like it, partly because you take nature sketches and combine it with this study of tradition of nativity scenes or the creche. And the way that they do this in Provence is a couple of things stand out. One is that they take native plants and decorate the creche with plants that are native to the place. And they also expand the cast of characters at the nativity from just the usual suspects to up to dozens or even hundreds of these little santons, so little saints who are essentially the baker, the butcher, the postman, you know, the country girl, all these. So we're going to talk more about those two aspects of your book later in the conversation, but you tie all these together in a journey through Advent. All of that said, as a little intro to your book, what was your journey, Sylvie, to writing this book?
That's a good question, especially as when one gets older, I look back certainly and see more and more connections in my life. So the older I am, the more I see little bits and pieces that make sense of where I am now, which I had maybe I would not have thought when I was younger. The love of my country, the understanding of the importance of the land and the traditions that emerge from it was always huge. And so then I had to make sense of it when I left. One thing that happened partly is when I started teaching French to little ones, I had to teach them language and culture. And I dug up a lot of cultural facts wanting to enrich my classes and realize again years later that to some extent my attachment to Provence was growing in inverse proportion to my distance from it. And to me, that happened in the process of writing this book, because I had always had a very busy life with, you know, homeschooling and then teaching kids in school. And suddenly, at one point in my life, I had to quit work. My life sort of came to a standstill for a while when we were trying to move and couldn't move, basically. And for 3 years, we kind of stood there waiting to see what happened. All these thoughts that I'd had about my land and the seasons and the cultural tidbits that I had picked up along the way, I, first of all, spent a lot more time in my garden, took classes in gardening. But then when I was there, I realized they also offered botanic art, which I really fell in love with. And I had always wanted to do art. I didn't think I would be very good at it necessarily. I mean, so these things combined together, and I started writing, starting to see how the seasons of nature and the seasons of the church were linked together. And then somehow, as I started going through the years, describing through the seasons, describing this kind of phenomenon of nature and culture linked together, and then illustrating it as well, I got to the Santon and to Advent. And I started realizing how, perhaps even more than ever before, how rich it was, how tied to the land. As I was talking to a few people about this little project of mine, more and more frequently I heard people say, you know, I would love to read. If you could make this into a book, I'd love to read it. And because I was at the same time taking care of my mother-in-law who had increasing dementia. She lived just next door. So I had this kind of floating free time, which is what you do with that. What I find fascinating in connection with the need that I emphasize so much in my book, the need for quiet, reflective time at Advent, is that it was a sort of Advent to me, and it happened because I had quiet. Things stopped. And I think oftentimes God comes in times like these. And we need to make this time, if we don't have it, in order to hear him and see him.
Yeah, exactly. I would love, Sylvie, to walk through your book, through the themes, because I think some people may still be asking themselves, okay, how exactly does the land and Advent and native plants and nativity sets and santons, like how do they all weave together? And so I'd like to do this for our listeners, but do it through some key words that you, some French words that you use through your book. And I'd love to start with this word, terroir, T-E-R-R-O-I-R, which I have to say, when I first saw it, I thought it was a cognate and I thought it meant terror. But you explain, there's this phrase, le terroir, c'est nous. The land is us, essentially. The land and everything in it is who we are. And so it's more related to the word territory, but territory is kind of hard and dry in comparison to what terroir really encompasses. So speaking about one's native land, I would love to talk to you about specifically native plants, which you love drawing, and the practice of drawing native plants, putting native plants in the creche. How have these practices related to native plants specifically taught you about Advent, about waiting for God? What's that connection there for you?
That's a very good question. And yes, it is the center of the project, in a sense. My sort of awakening, my aha moment, in a sense, for the book happened even several years before I started writing. So as you, I think you described earlier, the people in Provence sort of, they go on this Advent walk, in which they gather material from the land and to decorate the manger with. And it's a fascinating way of showing that Jesus has come to our land, not to a distant Bethlehem, although we know he has. At the end of the day, he came to Bethlehem because he came to be with us, each one of us now here. And one way to beautifully symbolize that is by putting the plants of our land around the birth of Jesus, because he came to us. So the terroir, yes, the terroir is the particular soil in your particular area that grow a particular thing, a particular kind of plants. So the terroir, this particular earth, creates a kind of culture through the people who cultivate it in a particular way. So that's why the people from Provence don't just have a different vegetation, but they're different people from other people. And they have that culture is kind of an inheritance that we pass down. And it makes me think a little bit of the first garden, where basically we were meant to cultivate that garden and be fruitful and multiply. And in planting Jesus in your own land with its own native plant, it's a way almost of showing we are returning to the garden, or he's coming to us to create a new garden. He's coming back to it and invites us to participate in it. And then you're asking about the importance of native plants. I think a few things that you realize through that, apart from the fact that it allows us perhaps to not fulfill, but at least to touch, to go back to that creation mandate and do something about it a little bit in our own fallen ways. But then something too about cultivating through the year with your native plant is you're aware of the cycle of life and death, of important things that sometimes even our culture hides, you know, the dying process. We see it in nature. It's there. And it's beautiful because there is death, but then the fruit falls to the ground and there is a seed and there is renewal. Mm-hmm. And there's that in Advent. Advent is a time when we're waiting in quietness for the new life in Christ. So there's that. So I think that's going back to a more gentle sort of rhythm of life. And all that is included by observing your land, that you inevitably do when you try to gather material for the cache.
That's beautiful, Sylvie, and so interesting too, because I love that you connected it to the Garden of Eden and to God's original, or the beginning of God's original vision for us was in this garden. The revelation of Jesus is also apocalyptic, but what it reveals in the technical sense of apocalypse, what it reveals to us is a deeply peaceable life, which is available to us in a new way through Jesus Christ. And so I don't know if you have any thoughts about that or any response to that, but I'll open the floor to you if you do.
Well, the one thing I thought of as you were saying that is when I, that year when finally I had time to dedicate to the garden and then eventually to the botanic arts more than ever before, because I had been so busy before that, I was struck every time I put my fingers in the earth, how much connection we have. And also how much Jesus uses the earth, the garden, cultivation in his teaching. And I know that people often say, well, that's because they were an agrarian culture. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know about that. I mean, he was a carpenter and so was his father. Did they have a garden? I don't know. Did he help his mother pull up the weeds? I have no idea, you know, whether there was any of that. But I think it goes beyond the fact that they were in an agrarian culture. I think it's because he knows we understand these images because there is so much connection that we have with the land. And so, and that's another thing that's beautiful about this crash scene that I'll come to later. But we were pulled out of the earth and asked to take care of it. And there is this intimate connection with the land that we're totally losing touch with. There's a term called ethnobotany, the connection between people and plants. God had intended for people and plants to work together by cultivating the land that you're given. And then he walks with us in the land, which is, I think, what Jesus initiates when he comes to us, to our land. And so including him in that manger scene with the plants is kind of almost like walking with him in the garden again.
Yeah, because if you create a manger scene with that's decorated with native plants like they do in Provence, then let's see, if it were in Georgia, we would have we'd have spiderwort, we'd have pine needles, lots of pine needles decorating the floor of the stable. We would have some azaleas, you know, for example. So then what I'm seeing is oh, Jesus is born in Georgia. You know, I'm seeing he was born to me in Decatur, Georgia. He was born to my neighbors. He is born. It comes alive in such a particular way. I am curious about the importance of imagination here and how it intersects with the journey of discipleship. Could you say more about the role that imagination plays in these deeply reflective seasons like Advent? Could it be that there's an element of becoming like a child again in this? What do you think?
Yes, totally. I think it's interesting that Advent and Christmas are kind of childish moments, but I think it's for people as well. For a minute there, you see the world through a child's eye. And what it is, first of all, so it plays a huge role, but it also, there has to be an intentionality. You need to sort of empty your calendar. Again, that I keep talking about Advent needing to be quiet, because oftentimes it is the busiest time of the year in many families, where you kind of preempt Christmas during Advent and then Christmas, we're moving on to other things. Just the intentionality to slow down and to make quiet and to clear the calendars and to get away from the cell phone some time of the day, I think it's very important. We are overscheduled. We're losing a sense of awe. I think that's well known. And our children are overscheduled as well. What is so important about, you know, belonging to all these clubs or going to all these meetings? And so imagination dares ask questions. What if? What if I did this differently this year? What if I brought in, you know, plants from my garden? Or what if I slow down and spend more time intentionally contemplating this incredible fact, this thing that happened in the incarnation, Christ coming to us? And that is the playfulness element. Children do ask, what if? What if I were a cow? What if there is a funny French song for children, which I love, which is, you know, what if asparaguses were blue? And what if, you know, whatever. And this is a typical thing that a child asks. But in this crash is, what if I were a santon, one of those little people who come to Jesus? Who would I be? What if I had a gift with him? What is that gift? What would that be? What if Jesus came to my land, not just to distant Bethlehem? What would it look like? And it does have an element of playfulness. You know, most people in this country have had some sort of role to play in some pageant. But let's make it something else. Not what if I were Mary or Joseph or a shepherd or a sheep or whatever, but what if I were... I mean, there must have been, again, that's a child's kind of play. There must have been people that night when he was born. And what did it?
Yeah.
What happened? Did anybody come and say, "Oh, do you need anything? Can I help you? You know, do you need a blanket? Do you need
or change Jesus' diaper?"
No, I know exactly. There must have been, and of course, the Bible does not talk about that. But that's this. The reason why this tradition in Provence is so fascinating is that people from Provence for centuries have actually gone there and asked, "What if? Oh, maybe this is what happened. What if the shepherds were scared stiff when they were told to go in the middle of the night and find that baby? Maybe they were scared."
Some of the Santons are depicted not just smiling and bringing gifts to Jesus, but they're depicted, you know, doing their work, maybe in the middle of kneading bread or something. But they're also depicted in arguments. They're depicted scared. They're depicted as flawed,
yes,
ordinary human beings, mm-hmm, and each one is a distinct individual, and they're all in a different spot in the manger scene. I imagine, I've never seen one of these Provence creches, but I imagine that some of them are closer into the manger. Others of them are gathered in little groups, you know, to the outside. Others maybe are, you know, haggling over something, you know, way over here and not even close to the manger yet. And so just the different places that they're placed also seems like incredible fodder, almost like godly play for adults.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Do you think that that's true?
Yes, totally. And so, yes, you, and then you imagine each one of these people that you just mentioned, flawed and not, how does Jesus coming to their place affect them? How is that going to be different? In fact, I adopted, when we said the creche, you know, Christmas Eve, they start all going to Jesus. I adopted last year, actually, I put an extra step in there. Instead of them turning around Christmas Eve and started moving to Jesus, I make them pause, just that, pause, turn around. That's conversion, you know, and I know it's what happens in at the cross is really what creates the conversion. But I think it starts at Advent, when people understand the incarnation, this incredible grace. And these people, they turn around and they stop.
So you mean that during Advent, the Santons are going about their business, mm-hmm, and then on Christmas Eve, they start. You literally pick up the little figurines and reposition them.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's so sweet. I love that. But you've added a third step, which is that you just turn them around in place so that they're attentive. And then on Christmas Day, I'm presuming then you move them, then they're all around closer into Mary, Joseph, the Christ child.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's so interesting.
And so it's not a static scene. That's the thing. It's an ongoing thing. And
yeah,
of course, if you have children,
it's a journey.
Yes, it is a journey, totally. And everybody can touch them and move them and do whatever they want with them, you know, in the family. And young children usually are told to make the first move
and not put them in their mouths.
Yes, well, that would be hard because they are clay. So that, and which is, by the way, another important fact is the connection. We came out of the earth. You know, God made this connection with the garden, and that they are made from the clay, from the land, is super important as well.
I see that. That's beautiful. What is it that should go to everyone on your Christmas list this year? Besides a cat a day calendar, I highly recommend one of those. But may I also suggest a few items from the Living Church? For anyone interested in the Anglican family, a Living Church magazine subscription is a great idea. We are the only independent news voice covering the Episcopal Church, Anglican Communion, and beyond, and each issue is packed with unique stories that only we write. Features, book art and film reviews, thoughtful opinion pieces, wise scriptural reflections, and more. And for the clergy in your life, may I recommend our new edition of Pastoral Ministrations of the Priest, a comprehensive collection of liturgical prayers for pastoral situations based on the Book of Common Prayer and a host of traditional sources. Leather-bound, gilt-edged, red-ribboned, great price. Or if your Christmas shopping is done,
Would you consider a gift to the Living Church? We are a nonprofit ministry. We are in this with you. This podcast, our reporting, our events, books, if we've served you this year in one of these ways, please let us know by leaving us a gift. You can find all these gift options at livingchurch.org under resources, subscribe, or donate. Also, you can check the links in the show notes. Well, we've talked a little about terroir and we talked a little about the Santon, and people can read so much more about them in your book. I would like to talk specifically about the Crèche for a moment and something that surprised me about the Crèche. We think of the manger scene as we've already said, a place for imaginative meditation, for adults becoming like children, of children playing with the figurines. It's sort of a cozy, you know, candlelight, hot cocoa manger scene. But actually the practice of a Crèche came out of persecution. Can you tell us that story? I just was fascinated by that.
Yes. So I'll tell you a little bit what I know. It came out of the French Revolution, which was a very messy time, not always recorded. Chaos, at least for the first 10 years. So obviously, like everybody knows, 1789, the king, you know, there was the guillotine and quite a few people lost their lives. All the royals, all the aristocrats, because the poor felt the oppression of just the times. And but it was not the only thing, because the clergy was associated with unjust, not just practices, but wealth. The wealth accumulated by the clergy was really associated to all the problems of the land. So the clergy was also sent to the guillotine, like so many other people. The Pope was openly against the revolution himself. And the churches were shut down. There was no more services. And in fact, the Cathedral of Notre Dame might not have been the only ones, because was dedicated to the goddess of reason after the first few years. And I think they just had meetings in there, the door was open. And then a few years later, it was dedicated to the cult of the supreme being. So they moved from reason to deism.
Wow.
Yeah, Notre Dame. So it was during that sort of chaotic period that persons started thinking, oh, and actually the important thing is the churches and even some of the castles from aristocrats and so on were places that used to display crèche scenes, manger scenes, not with all the little people, just the traditional Holy Family and whatnot.
Like the large scale.
Yes. Sometimes some of them were live. A few people, you know, presented a live manger scene. But a lot of the time it was maybe, I don't know, a foot high or more characters of the Holy Family and the Magi. And so it was a way of educating the people. So the churches did that and aristocrats did that. And of course, there was no representation allowed anymore during the revolution. Everything was destroyed. So there was no way to educate the people because they didn't have their Bibles in those days and so on. And so somebody had the thought of, okay, how about if we made miniature scenes that could go sort of, it was a replication in miniature, a subversive way of continuing the story during a time of repression. And some of those were artists. By the way, the term that they used at the time, thinking the church and the royals and the aristocrats, so the revolutionaries actively search to de-Christianize, de-Christianize France. That was the term.
Wow.
Amazing. And they did a pretty good job at it because it was the opening of the modern age and so on. But so anyway, these little crèche scenes would be introduced with the characters. They did not just represent the Holy Family, but in a sense, they democratized it.
Mm.
Deciding to include other people around Jesus. So suddenly they resisted the prohibition put on religious representation, and They allowed for everybody to have them. They were, the big thing is they had to be affordable for everybody. So they were, but then also that was the first time ever that they started, probably because of the revolution, to actually include all the mundane little jobs coming to Jesus. So this is incredible, in a sense, renewal through persecution, because this is something that nobody had ever done before, just to include the baker, you know, the butcher and the candle maker, as you're saying, coming to Jesus. And suddenly there is no more separation between sacred and mundane. And privileges were not just for the clergy and the wealthy. The people who could come to Jesus were not just the clergy anymore. They were everybody. So that was, it was an amazing, and that was in the early 1800s when it happened.
Do you know what I love about that too, Sylvie, is that the creche was by default, because it was being invented during this time of de-Christianization, political and subversive in two directions. It was subversive to those who were trying to de-Christianize France. It was also subversive to the previous status quo and the sort of the stronghold of the aristocracy over other people, or aristocratic ideas and ideals and a kind of caste system in France. And it just strikes me, I've had conversations for the podcast that have touched on this several times in the past several months, Christian politics being subversive in both directions. It's subversive going right and it's subversive going left, because it's speaking about something that is beyond what we could have invented ourselves. It's speaking about God's vision for us and for our flourishing, which is more than what we can imagine for ourselves. And I just love thinking of the creche as a little symbol of that.
Yes. And you talk about more than we can imagine. It goes back to the imagination. What would it look like at the end? It's not about necessarily politics. It's about Christ in the midst of us. So yes. What does it look like for each of us, no matter what we do? And maybe we're wealthy, maybe we're poor, you know, and they have all generations in there, you know, all kinds of jobs. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And how is that presence of Christ going to affect how we do everything? And you talk about politics. One of the centons, the little figure, is actually a mayor. So how is that going to affect him?
Ooh,
interesting.
I love it. You have politicians at the manger scene. You have peasants at the manger scene. You have shepherds, you know, not just the ones who Jesus, you know, that his birth was announced to, but shepherds and farmers who are working, who are at the manger scene. Well, now that I've mentioned shepherds, can I ask you a question about the shepherds? Because they play a particular role in your book. You've already touched on a little bit this, the practice of making space for silence, quiet, which would include, and you again talk about this more in your book, solitude. And you use shepherds as an example of being in solitude, which can be lonely and desolating, but which can also be spiritually rich and enlightening. I'm curious what you have learned about loneliness that just is kind of soul-sucking and not spiritually fruitful versus fruitful solitude from meditating on shepherds, maybe literal shepherds, you know, from your childhood in Provence, or these little Santon shepherds in the manger scene.
So, yes, shepherds are huge in Provence still. It's so much, I mean, they're part of our terroir, basically. So they belong there. And whether you see them, people usually see them because at Advent, people, even if they're not shepherds, although there are some, but dress up as shepherds and take, you know, sort of start the celebrations of Advent with their sheep and so on. So you see them, you know them, but it's just the idea that they spend time on their own. And you have to wonder, as in scripture, oftentimes God appears to his people when they are on their own. And I know he can talk anywhere and anytime, and he could appear right now in the middle of me when I'm talking. But there is something about searching him in solitude. Loneliness is a very different thing. Loneliness is feeling alone because you feel disconnected, you feel you don't belong, you have no purpose. Solitude is something you seek because you know your purpose. You know you belong to a greater story, I think. And that's very important. And so you kind of recenter yourself in that story. And as I said, especially in Advent, it's kind of, it used to be a time when the church allowed for quiet to reconnect with a great meaning and the beginning again of everything, of the reliving the life of Christ through the church calendar. So I think for me, perhaps loneliness, funny enough, apart from my non-Christian years when I was searching, which I still call my long Advent walk in the night, because I was putting myself in the path of solitude, I noticed, and there's something so human about that, but I noticed that I felt less lonely in a sense when I was in the hills, in the mountains, in nature, which is very biblical, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. So you suddenly realize there's something else out there. But also when I arrived in the States and we lived in a new suburban area, we didn't go to a liturgical church. And I really felt myself a little lost there. And I think through thinking, and because I was alone, I did more praying and thinking and so on. And I thought, I need to find a way, even if I'm on my own, to reconnect to the great story, because this is going nowhere. This is when I really started thinking, so how can I plug in those times into my calendar, our family calendar? But it all started with solitude, with finding, well, initially with loneliness, and then realizing that I needed to plug into a greater story, to regain this sense of recenter myself, regain this sense of belonging to something bigger, I think. And I think that the shepherds do that beautifully. Yeah, it all goes back to, which is what I try to do with my book, is the important thing is I have a role in the greater story to which I belong, you know, and that changes perspective on everything.
Sylvie, I remember that the first time I was in what's called a blue zone, which means that there's no light pollution. For my 30th birthday, a friend of mine took me out to Arkansas basically to go stargazing. And it was a surprise. I didn't know what we were going to go do. And so we're out 11 p.m. on a mountain in Arkansas. And I had never and have never since seen, I didn't realize how full the sky was of stars. I had never really seen the Milky Way. I didn't realize that stars were different colors. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs mostly, and I've always enjoyed nature and animals and plants. And my parents will tell you I was horrible at playing softball when I was a kid because I would just end up examining the grass and the flowers and not catch the ball. But this was such a profound experience for me. Different biblical stories came alive for me, references to stars. You know, God's promises to Abraham, the morning stars sang together, sons of God shouted for joy. Like you said, this is so human to get into a place of solitude with intention. And you don't always get an epiphany, right? You don't always get this magical moment. No, and that's part of it as well. But you make space to be alone with God and thus be less alone, which is part of what Advent is all about. I just want to mention one final French word, attendre, attendre, which really is not a false cognate. It's pretty close to the English word attend, which has these multiple meanings of waiting, listening, and also sort of waiting to serve. Like someone that works at a restaurant would attendre, you know, on the people there. And I think that that's a word that sums up in some ways beautifully what you're describing about the purpose of Advent and the practices of celebrating Advent in place, what that entails. Feel free to comment. And then I have one final very practical, quick question for you.
So what I see about the French crèche, and I do say it's not about Provence in a sense. It's just Provence gives us this incredible parable. So we use it and see how we can transpose it to our place. But there is a wondrous exchange that's so visual that when you have the traditional crèche of Jesus being born in Bethlehem and you set it up there, first of all, it's a static thing. Once it's set out, you don't touch it. You don't need to touch it anymore. But it's not necessarily connected, so obviously connected to me. The crèche from Provence, where Jesus comes to my land with the farmhouse, which is my architecture, is God making, stretching out to us, which is another meaning of the term to attendre. It's this stretching out, which is the accommodation that God makes, even as he makes himself man, to come and rescue us. And in the crèche scene, the wondrous exchange is that as he does that, we joyfully respond and we do the same. We come to him. These little saints come to God to Jesus with their gifts because he's come to us. And so he comes to us to serve us and we respond by serving him. His coming to us is a sign of hospitality. That's him. Hospitality to us, because at the end of the day, he wants to welcome us back in the garden. And we respond by being hospitable to him in our land, in all of our places. And I argue through the other book, in everything we do every day of the year. Advent is kind of a practice of that. It's, I call it an apprenticeship. In a sense, we have 4 weeks to become apprenticed to this way of welcoming Jesus, of attending to him, serving him, partly by serving others, obviously, because that's the other funny thing about those scenes is the Santons come to Jesus with baskets of fruit or whatever, and well, Jesus is not going to eat the fruit. So that is a symbol of what we do for others, we do for him. So that's this attending, but it really has to do with this God stretching down to us, and we stretch up to him in all we do.
Yeah, it reminds me of a parent reaching down to a little child who's reaching up. And there, you know, there are so many beautiful images. I think it's the book of Isaiah. Someone who knows this better than me can email me and correct me. But when God says, I took you to my cheek, I picked you up like a small child and I took you to my cheek. And to think of Advent as being a way of practicing that kind of relating to God, that we wait on him as he waits on us in all the fullness of those words, wherever we are, whether you're in the middle of big, beautiful flowers and trees and whatever, or whether you are in the middle of a city and all you can do is a potted pothos in your windowsill, every place he comes to us and waits on us. And so I'm grateful for that reminder, Sylvie. I've been speaking today with Sylvie Van Hooser, certified botanic artist and author of the devotional, The Art of Living in Advent, 28 Days of Joyful Waiting. Sylvie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. You can learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. If you'd like to buy Sylvie's book, The Art of Living in Advent, InterVarsity Press would love to give you 20% off plus free shipping. Use discount code IVPPOD20 at ivpress.com. You can also find this info in the show notes. In 2 weeks, how do Christians listen to one another through mutual skepticism? We'll enjoy a conversation across difference with Catholic missioner David Smith and Dean of Pentecostal Theological Seminary, David Hahn, about their experience in some of the most creative ecumenical dialogues happening today. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.